Back together again, you and I, kicking off a brand new week, Monday, the 17th of April, 2023, on Connecticut Today. We talked about the latest U.S. military intelligence breach by apparently a young Massachusetts Air National Guardsman. Attorney and author Thomas Weaver joined us to chat about the new book, The Electoral College, a biography of America's peculiar creation through the eyes of the people who shaped it. So I'm a little conflicted here. I have to admit it because I've been going back and forth on something here, and I'm really conflicted here, and I wanted to open with this because other than the terrible shootings we had across the U.S. and even more shootings here in Connecticut over the weekend, the story here about this 21-year-old Massachusetts Air National Guardsman who has been arrested. He had a brief court appearance. Another one is coming up, I think, this week or next week for this 21-year-old Air National Guardsman, Jack Teixeira. And you probably saw the video of some very heavily armed military members in the area of his suburban home taking him into custody. It was video seen all over the country, and a lot of people, you know, including myself, when you see stuff like that, you say, well, good, you know, you, whatever branch of the military you're in, Army, Navy, Air Force, Marines, Coast Guard, Space Force, National Guard, you, I know you take an oath. I've never done it. I've never been to the military, but I have friends of mine and, of course, much older relatives, most of whom who've since passed on. And they take this pretty seriously. You know, you're not supposed to reveal secrets. Even anybody with a, you know, a cursory understanding of this knows that while that may technically not be treason unless it's in wartime and we can get wrapped up in all the machinations of that, it's a bad thing. Or is it? Now, before you jump at me here and say, well, what the heck is the matter with you, Paul? You should be the last person to, you know, show sympathy for somebody who leaks classified information. And I agree with you. On face, it's not a good thing because I do believe officials when they say, hey, listen, when people do this, when they take it upon themselves to be judge, jury, and somewhat of an executioner here on this stuff, they are invariably putting other people at risk. We've heard that from our Pentagon officials over the past week or so. You know, when they said, hey, part of the problem is this info, even if it's not that vital, other countries, other adversaries can put two and two or three and three together and say, hey, well, if this was in that stuff that this kid Teixeira leaked, then there's only one or two ways he could have gotten this. So, you know, let's go, you know, beat the crap out of somebody and torture somebody and see if we have a mole amongst us. We get that. I understand that. But as has been in the past with some of these, you know, leaks per se, and, you know, people are comparing this, they're comparing him to Edward Snowden, but they're comparing, you know, the leak of this material, and this is where it becomes tricky here, to the Pentagon Papers, and you remember that was connected with Daniel Ellsberg and the New York Times, and basically the Pentagon Papers was a leak or a series of leaks or documents, you know, published by the Times that told America, hey, this Vietnam thing isn't going as great as everybody says it is. Okay, I understand that. Now, were people that surprised at the time? Maybe, maybe not. But this is where I got to really kind of thinking about this over the weekend. And I'm asking you at 203-333-9422, 333-WICC, even if you've been in the military, even if you or your husband or wife or domestic partner or son or daughter, grandson, granddaughter, niece, nephew, whatever, even if they or you have taken an oath, is there any way you're in favor of this if in the long run it illustrates things that we're not being told, or maybe we should know. Now, this all goes back to the theory of, well, there's a need-to-know basis, and for countries to remain, you know, stable, for a stability here, you've got to maybe lie, I don't know, or not tell the truth, I don't know, not sure. Now, the leaked documents ended up on a server, what's called a Discord server here, and apparently these documents were floating around out there for a few days before, you know, somebody noticed this. Now, we're finding out, I guess, in some of these documents, and this is where I'm torn, because we weren't, or we weren't given, at least up front, for example, the real story or the full story with these Chinese spy balloons. Now, apparently, allegedly, in some of these documents, there was word that, well, there may have been a lot more of these Chinese spy balloons. And some of these documents have also detailed some things that would make the common person in America say, oh, if this is happening over our skies, what are you people in the government doing? Now, the Washington Post is reporting, we'll get to the phones momentarily, Sam and Milford, you'll be first up, hang on here. The Washington Post is reporting, for example, that Chinese spy balloon that was shot down a couple of months ago, it may have had something called synthetic aperture radar. Now, what does that do? Well, it sounds high-tech, and it is. The technology has the ability to observe objects in the dark or through clouds. SAR is used around the world by NASA and the European Space Agency. At the time, much about the balloon, says here in the Washington Post, was not known publicly, but a new trove of Pentagon documents show that there were four other previously unknown spy balloons like it. They could have that feature known as synthetic aperture radar that can see right through certain objects. So again, my point here is, when these leaks happen, generally, you can go back to the Pentagon Papers, even some stuff with the Edward Snowden leaks, but a lot of times, and who knows why these people are doing these things, but after the immediate anger, and I don't blame folks, men and women, for being angry, especially if they're military veterans or maybe active duty, you know, you sit there and you say, well, he shouldn't have done it, but maybe the American people weren't told the whole story. And then that can also reflect on a need-to-know basis. 203-333-9422, 333-WICC. Can you be upset at a leaker like this kid? And I know he's 21. He's not technically a kid, but he's a kid. Now I sound like the old white guy. Get off of my lawn. 21-year-old Jack Teixeira, you know, downloads these documents, photocopies them, whatever, and puts photos up of them on some gamer boards. And all of a sudden, Congress and the Pentagon are scrambling here. Well, should he have had access to this? And after you see some of the things that Teixeira has revealed, do you say to yourself, well, he shouldn't have done it, but I think people need to know some of what he released. Well, Mr. Announcer there used the phrase crazy ideas, and a lot of people think in this day and age the Electoral College is a crazy idea, and folks on the other side say no, the Electoral College keeps us from descending into a crazy idea. The name of the book, The Electoral College, a biography of America's peculiar creation through the eyes of the people who shaped it. The author's our next guest. He's been a criminal defense lawyer in the state of Washington since back in 1993, arguing hundreds of cases. He's also a lifelong student of American history, and he has wrote the aforementioned book. We welcome lawyer and author Thomas Weaver to the show. Hey, Tom, it's Paul at WICC. How are you?
I'm good. Thank you.
Electoral College, fascinating thing, isn't it? Is there anything else like it around the world, or are we the lone country that makes our candidates, Tom, at least in my opinion, concentrate on every state if they want to win?
Well, we are unique. Most Democratic countries in the world subscribe to one of two systems. They either determine their chief executive, their president, prime minister, whoever it is, by a popular vote of the people, or they rely on the Congress or the, in England it's the House of Commons. Mm-hmm. They will pick the House of Commons will pick a prime minister, which is kind of like our Speaker of the House, but in terms of how he's selected, but he functions more as a chief executive, more like our president.
What are the origins, Tom, of the Electoral College? And I know a lot of people who criticize it say, well, it's outmoded and it was only done to please the slaveholding states. Talk about that.
Well, the Electoral College came about as part of the Constitutional Convention of 1787. It was the two popular modes that I just discussed, popular election versus having Congress select the chief executive. Those were discussed at the Constitutional Convention, and they were rejected for a variety of reasons that I discuss in my book. Your question suggests one of the major reasons why it was rejected, and that is disagreements between the northern states and the southern states over how to deal with slavery.
Mm-hmm.
Much of my book deals with the history and the impact of the Three-Fifths Clause. Most people know that under the original Constitution, slaves were treated as three-fifths of a person in the census that we had every 10 years. The issue was how to translate that Three-Fifths Clause into voting. I mean, are we going to give slaves three-fifths of a vote? Where are we going to give them zero votes? Are we going to and so all of these things came into play. And I do in my book, I do a deep dive into the Three-Fifths Clause. It actually predates the Constitution. It's actually goes back to the Articles of Confederation, and I discuss that history extensively throughout my book.
Oh, man, you can argue with people left and right, sometimes fascinatingly, about the Electoral College, how we elect a president, a presidential ticket here in the U.S. Essentially, it means winning individual states. Tom Weaver, attorney and author, name of the book, The Electoral College, a biography of America's peculiar creation through the eyes of the people who shaped it. Tom, how do we know what the people who shaped it thought? Was this research you did to come up with a deep look into how they felt about this whole thing, putting it together? Because I guess, did they have anything to go on in trying this or not?
Well, to a certain extent, the United States was trying an experiment as the first nation to try and accomplish democracy on a large scale. There had been smaller democracies on a small scale, but this was the largest scale that had been done. We know quite a bit about what happened during the Constitutional Convention from the notes that were taken by people there, primarily James Madison.
Mm-hmm.
James Madison was there every day of the convention, and he took extensive notes of what happened. We know who spoke, what the individual votes were on the various clauses. Almost every clause of the Constitution was extensively debated and argued over. The Electoral College, however, came about at the very end of a very hot, humid summer, and in his letters, even James Madison admitted that it was probably put together a little bit too hastily without sufficient thought.
The one thing that, that may be the one, not argument I have against it, Tom, but the peculiar thing, and correct me if I'm wrong, these are generally winner-take-all states. There are very few states, if I'm correct, that award, I know some do, that award their electoral votes proportionally, correct?
Yeah, there are currently two states, Maine and Indiana, that Maine and Nebraska, I apologize, award them proportionally. In the early years of the Republic, the first couple decades, they that was not the case. But once one state did it, they all kind of fell into line with this one person wins all. And by the election of 1824, all of the states had adopted it. The Maine and Nebraska states have – that's a relative recent change for them. For most of our country's history, all states did the winner-take-all approach.
And, you know, Tom, it's interesting. I read people who say, well, maybe if you're not going to get rid of the Electoral College, try more proportional representation, which would mean, for example, I mean, I'm talking to you from an obvious blue state here in Connecticut, but the derivation of the blueness is generally 55 to 45. So, you know, maybe it would bring, for example, my state here in Connecticut into more of the loop of campaigning. If somebody thought that even if they lost here, they could end up getting two or three electoral votes.
And if you look at the history of proposed constitutional amendments to the Constitution in general and the Electoral College specifically, that is the most common proposal. And proposals date back to even the first Congress to try and require mandatory electoral districting. And we have congressional districting now, which they didn't have actually in the earliest days of the Republic. Mm-hmm. There were winner-take-all in the earliest years. There were winner-take-all on the congressional level as well, but they quickly moved to districting with the House of Representatives, and it would not be difficult to do that with the Electoral College. And I agree with you that that would create a significant amount of balance in the Electoral College. The other proposal at the end of my book that I propose is to get rid of the plus two. So every state gets a number of electors equal to the number of representatives it has plus the number of senators,
yeah,
which is fixed at two per state. So if you look at the, for instance, the population of California, which has 52 representatives and 54 electors, its population equals that of the 22 smallest states, and they have twice as many electors as California does, even though they have an equal number of population.
The name of the book, once again, The Electoral College, a biography of America's peculiar creation through the eyes of the people who shaped it. Tom Weaver is the guest. Tom, I guess, correct me if I'm wrong, the chief argument for keeping the Electoral College, even if it's modified a bit in the coming decades, is I've seen something, and this may be off by a state or two, forgive me, that if you went with a strict popular vote in this country, you'd have maybe 10 or 12 states that would essentially decide every election?
Well, I mean, if you went to a strict popular vote, mm-hmm, then, well, I'm not sure that it would be reduced down to a handful of states, yeah, per se, because if we had national elections, then, you know, you could theoretically challenge the results not only statewide, but countywide or even citywide. You know, say you could accuse a particular county of, you know, fraud, corruption,
yeah,
intimidation, whatever you want to say, and it would create a system where we could theoretically bog down the courts and Congress trying to resolve all of these micro disputes, where currently these micro disputes are being handled at the local level, primarily the states, but also the counties and cities. Alexander Hamilton in Federalist 68, his primary reason for why the Electoral College was proposed by the Constitutional Convention was to limit fraud. So through fraud or corruption, you can affect an election on a small scale, but it's very difficult when every state is using a different system. They're using different voting machines or using different systems. It's very difficult under the way we have it right now to truly affect a national election through fraud.
Yeah, I can understand that. Tom, final question, and I know you mentioned somebody who thought or the idea that it was rushed a little bit, but looking back at your research, who was, maybe was there a name or two of whomever was around back then when this was all put together, who said, look, this is a horrible idea, it is unfair, and we should not do this? Was there really, was there a name or two we would recognize who didn't want to go along with this at all?
Not really. This was the product of a compromise over the course of a summer. And if you read the Federalist Papers, and specifically Federalist 68, which was written by Alexander Hamilton, he claims in the very first sentence of Federalist 68 that it's the only clause in the Constitution that hadn't been criticized. Of course, then the Constitution gets ratified, and it's become one of the most criticized clauses.
Right. The best laid plans. Tom Weaver, thank you. Once again, name of the book, The Electoral College, a biography of America's peculiar creation through the eyes of the people who shaped it, attorney and author Tom Weaver. Tom, thank you. I'm going to download the PDF. We'll give it a read. Thank you, sir. Take care.
Thank you very much.
Appreciate it, Tom Weaver. All right, folks, pick it up. I love this stuff. It's fascinating. When you look back and you analyze what the founding fathers and mothers, too, husbands, wives, what the founding fathers thought, don't think that you don't think they went home at night and snuggled up, pillow talk, and talked to their wives about such things as the Electoral College and representation? Come on. Of course they did. It's just back then nobody mentioned it.